The Holy Roman Empire, we've already glanced at it when we looked at the big picture in our introductory work on this section, the church of the early Middle Ages up to 1122. We were last looking at the donation of Constantine, and I was trying to put it in its context. Let me just say a word about this to get our minds back together on this subject. That what is going on is that there is an attempt to bring order out of chaos. Law and order is breaking down. Civilization is breaking down. And the single strong force is the church. The church is very wealthy now. The church is a great landowning institution. It is highly organized in the South under the diocesan arrangement, the bishops especially. And as the, so the, there, there is, now listen to me, there is a, the problem is twofold. First of all, this is the general framework of it. If you understand this, it'll help you to understand, at least in broad terms, what is going on with the Holy Roman Empire. First of all, is the chaos, the breakdown of order. Second is the problem created by the fact that you have these Frankish rulers, the strongest of the northern peoples, the Franks. The leaders of the Franks are trying to establish a legitimate system, a legitimate dynasty. And the church is in the way. The church is jealously guarding its power, its prerogative, and the church is marching to the drumbeat of Augustine, which says that with the fall of the city of man, or pagan Rome being an example of the city of man, it is now time for what? The city of God. Christendom, a Christian society. Christian. In a Christian society, who's in charge? Who's in charge? You have the state-church problem. That is, who in this new order is being established? Is the church going to be the servant or the master? And as we saw that the church made a deal with the Franks, they granted legitimacy to Frankish rule. In return, the Franks defended the church against the Lombards, agreed to defend their property. But you see, it's not that simple. Who is in charge? It's as simple as that. Who's in charge? Is this the city of God? Is this a theocracy? Is this a Christian society? And if it is, does this mean that the church is in charge? And if the church is in charge, what man claims that the authority in the West? The Bishop of Rome. So by that logic, you see, if this is the city of God, if this is going to be the Holy Roman Empire as opposed to the pagan Roman Empire, if this new order that's going to arise out of this mess, this chaos, is going to be a Christian society, then by logical deduction, is not the head of the church the man in charge, the Bishop of Rome? He says yes. And the Franks, who are nominally Christian, very nominally, they are going to establish a kingdom which is to be Christian, but does it mean that that the king is a servant of the church, that of the Pope? And they would say, well, no. See, the question is, as the Franks would view it, that the church is a legitimate part of society, but that the king must be in charge. Who is? Well, we're going to see that go through this today, that the church wins out, practically speaking, if not theoretically, simply because the church is stronger. The church is more wealthy, it's more unified, better organized, and the church can do that which we're going to see the Frankish kings cannot do. They control a very superstitious age, and the church has convinced its people, the people of Western Europe now, that the Bishop of Rome can decide who goes to heaven and who goes to hell. In the dark, superstitious age, that gives him the ace. That gives him final. You see, that gives him more functioning authority. We're going to see that the church wins out, kind of a Pyrrhic victory, but they win. Are you with me now? So you have chaos, the attempt to establish order in chaos, but the problem of who's in charge in this Holy Roman Empire, the church or the state? We come now on page 123, moving very quickly, to the reign of Charlemagne, or Charles the Great. He's come down as Charlemagne, the greatest, he's the son of Pepin. We've already met him. He's the greatest of the Frankish rulers. He was a great administrator, a great warrior. As I point out here, he succeeded in exercising authority over the land area of the old Roman Empire in the west, not the east, and more actual territory in the west than Rome itself had administered. That is, he got up all the way up into... See, the Holy Roman Empire goes all the way to the North Sea, to the Baltic Sea, and this is northern Germany, Saxony, where Luther is going to come from, as we said. Well, Charlemagne was able to have exercise military authority over that whole area. Rome was never able to do that. They never were able to extend their authority all the way to the Baltic. But let me make this statement, that under Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Empire came the closest that it was going to come to working. And it worked only in that Charlemagne was a strong military leader. What was his relationship to the church? First of all, he extended the church. We've already talked about the fact how he imposed Christianity on the German peoples east of the Rhine, did not win their hearts. Who was it that won the hearts of the people to Christianity? You recall? Remember, missionaries from England, missionaries from Anglo-Saxon missionaries came over. But he extended the church, at least formally. Secondly, he used the church in trying to establish what we would call a bureaucracy, a system of government that would work. He depended upon churchmen to do the administrative and clerical work simply because they alone had the necessary learning. He had to depend upon mainly monks, the church officials, to carry on, to be the administrative clerks, to be the functionaries in his system, in his government, because only they could do it. And so he extended the church, he used the church, he controlled the church. The church was very wealthy, as we've pointed out, and Charlemagne simply appropriated this wealth whenever he needed it. You see, the church was not militarily strong, obviously, and Charlemagne was, and so he simply took what he wanted. He gave ecclesiastical offices, which had revenues attached to them, to benefactors, sort of a political job. You support me and I'll give you a good job. Some were laymen who were ordained with no regard for their spiritual character, as I pointed out. He considered himself the head of the church, and he actually had the welfare of the church in his mind. But the result was that the church became even more worldly, even more secular. On Christmas Day, AD 800, Charlemagne was at Rome in a religious service. He's in church. And the Pope, Bishop of Rome, didn't know what Charlemagne was going to do, but he had a crown hidden under his robes. He walked up to Charlemagne, whipped out this crown, and proceeded to place it on the head of Charlemagne and proclaimed him the successor of the Caesars. That is, he acknowledged his rule down into Italy. You see how the yellow part of our map extends down into the middle part of Italy? I'll not walk over there because of the tape recorder. You see that? Now, wasn't that nice of the Pope? See, was he acknowledging what was he was saying? That he, this is, in other words, when he said, he acknowledged him to be the legitimate heir of the Caesars, the Holy Roman Empire was born on that day. That it was officially begun. He is not simply the head of the Frankish peoples. He is now the head of the Roman Empire in the West. The Holy Roman Empire is on this day, Christmas Day, the 1800. But you see, although Charlemagne was surprised, he did accept the crown. But what was the significance of this gesture? What was the significance of the Pope crowning Charlemagne? Why would the Pope want to do that, such a dramatic gesture? Yes. See, who gave the crown? Let me ask you this. Who has the highest authority, the one who wears the crown or the one who gives the crown? Obviously, it's the one who gives the crown. And so the Pope was, symbolically at least, asserting his authority over Charlemagne. He couldn't exercise it too much, but there was the struggle. Who's in charge? Who crowns who? Yes. Well, he was asserting his, he was claiming his authority. He was claiming authority by this gesture. The greatness of the Roman Empire was still a cultural myth. That is, people still talk about the glory of Rome. The kingdom of Charlemagne, as I've already said, was conceived to be God's representative over the Christian version of the Rome of Augustus and Tiberius. And the paradigm, of course, was Augustine's city of God. We've already discussed this. I put that statement in to kind of summarize what I've said. The whole Roman Empire, by the way, lasted, on paper at least, until the fall to the failure of Napoleon. It lasted a long time, but it was always an idea, primarily. By the way, I put this in the syllabus. At this time, it is accepted that time is dated from the birth of Christ. You begin to have the general use of B.C. and A.D. at this time, in this time period. You know that? That's where it began. Well, Charlemagne, as I say, came the closest of any of the Frankish kings to making the Holy Roman Empire a reality. The Pope set it up formally, established it, and by the crowning of Charlemagne. But when Charlemagne died, his kingdom was divided. France went its own way. France went one way, Germany went the other. From this point on, they have separate histories. That's why this map shows at a later period, you see France and the Holy Roman Empire being separate. Originally, they were all one, technically at least. But after the death of Charlemagne, his sons divided up the empire. It disintegrated. It never really existed as a viable unifying force anyway. And so, what happened? Well, Western Europe simply lapsed back into feudalism. It was never really out of it. That is, feudalism was developing all this time. Feudalism would work, you see. It's okay to have something on paper, to have something in theory. The Holy Roman Empire didn't work. Feudalism worked. Why? Because it was a very simple arrangement of mutual loyalties. And it's about the only kind of thing that could work in that day, in that kind of age. The church, I say a word here about the church and the feudal system. The church became a land-holding part of the feudal system, and you can read that statement. We've already talked about the fact that there were bishops and abbots whose land covered more than 100,000 acres. Even the poorest held 5,000 acres or more. The church became a great feudal landholder, the largest single feudal landholder. And thus it became very, very powerful. It intimidated secular nobility by assuming and exercising the right to release dukes from their obligation to the king. That is, in these mutual loyalties, if a lesser aristocrat pledged loyalty to a great lord, if he wanted to get out of it, he could pay something to the church. The church could release him. That is, the church could, in a sense, destroy a feudal lord. And so, by threatening excommunication, the Pope became the most powerful man in Europe. Well, what happened was, let me simply summarize now, the attempt to have a semi-secular empire failed with the death of Charlemagne. It never really succeeded. And so with feudalism, which is decentralized, which is local, especially in a world where the church is so very powerful, owns so much land, controls so much, and as people believe, controls the eternal destiny of people, the church sort of won out in this struggle. The church was able to become exceedingly powerful in a feudal system. Can you see that, how it would work? Well, it's difficult for our minds to get a hold of that. But this needed to be legitimized. We come now to the pseudo-Isidorian decretals. Let me say a word about these. These were a series of forgeries. They were purported to have been gathered by the scholar Isidore of Spain, hence their name. They present themselves as decrees from popes beginning in the first century. Some of their material is genuine. Most of it is not.
I summarize the Isidorian Decretals. This is what they claim. First of all, the spiritual power of the Pope is infinitely superior to the secular power of kings and princes. Now, look what's going on. These Isidorian Decretals claim to be decrees from the bishops of Rome, leaders of the church, all the way back to the beginning. One of the issues is that the spiritual power of the Pope is superior to the secular power of the kings. Is that not the issue? See? And so the church's position is that the church is in charge, and these Isidorian Decretals are offered as evidence supporting this position. Secondly, the bishops stand in the same relation to the Pope that the other apostles stood in relation to Peter. That is, he has single authority. Third, provincials can be held only when summoned by the Pope, that is, provincial councils, and their decisions are valid only after receiving the approval of the Pope. That is, the Pope is superior not only to bishops, but also to councils. And this is, by the way, this is fought over for a long time. We're going to see them get to the Protestant Reformation. This debate is still going on. Do the councils have authority over the Pope, or the Pope over the councils? Well, these Isidorian Decretals says that the Bishop of Rome does. Fourth, the clergy constitutes the divine family, or the spirituals, while the laity are the carnals. So you have the spiritual estate versus the lay estate. And last, none of the clergy may be summoned before a secular tribunal, which shows the authority of the church over the state. What was the purpose, overall, as I state here, to justify claims being made by the papacy by making it appear that these claims have always been made and have always been recognized? And by the way, this is the standard methodology of the Roman Catholic Church. You see, it's one thing to claim the authority that they claim, to teach the doctrines they teach. But the real problem is their claim that not only does the church teach this, but the church has always taught this. So this is typical cult methodology. Remember 1984, George Orwell and Newspeak? You see, his job was to go back and through the computers and rewrite the news of the past so that what is true today, what we claim to be true today, has always been true. What the government says now, it has always said, even though that wasn't true. So in history, it's called revisionism. Did you get that? Very important device. The Roman Catholic Church has always used it. Cults use it. But the communists use it. Rewrite, go back. In other words, if you're going to take a position, you're going to claim authority, and it stems from God and from Peter, where did the idea come from that Peter was the first pope? Well, we can trace it in history and see that it came very late. See, they can't have that. So history is rewritten to claim that the church, see, it must be established. Are you with me now? If the Roman Catholic system is going to stand, it must be established not only that the Bishop of Rome is the head of the church, it must be established that the church has always recognized that. And the pseudo-Isidorian Decretals these documents are clear examples of this program of revisionism. And basically what they're doing is they're saying, they were forgeries, they were spurious documents saying that the claims that the Bishop of Rome is making now are not new. The Bishop of Rome has always claimed this authority, and this authority has always been given to him. Yes? Pardon? Well, no, the Roman Catholic Church has been forced to acknowledge that they're false. Hence they're called pseudo-Isidorian. But they still claim, they agree with, that is, they don't agree, they'll admit that most of these, at least, are false. Yet they will still claim the authority claimed by these decretals. You see what's going on? See, in this battle where the church is asserting itself over even Charlemagne, they say, well, this is nothing new. This is the traditional historic position of the church. What was the source of the decretals? Apparently they were written in France by an unknown author. They reflect the struggle of the clergy to maintain its power against the state, as I've been saying. They were not written by the popes, but they were used by the popes.
These became an issue in the Reformation. Which brings us to Pope Nicholas I, who was the strongest pope in the early Middle Ages. Remember we looked at Leo and Gregory earlier? But now we come to this period, we have Nicholas I. He was the first pope to really use the donation of Constantine, for instance. And I give you a couple of examples in the syllabus to show you the actual power of the pope. In contrast to Charlemagne, who really couldn't pull it off, at least his sons couldn't. The pope could. For example, Lothair II, who was the king of Lorraine, these Frankish peoples, he mistreated and finally divorced his wife and married his mistress, Waldredal is the W pronunciation. And not only did he marry his mistress, he put the queen's crown on her and paraded her as his queen. And everybody knew that he had divorced the legitimate queen. Well, the local ecclesiastical authorities sanctioned the divorce. Well, money was paid, of course. The queen, the injured party, promptly appealed to the Bishop of Rome. Nicholas was Bishop of Rome, Nicholas I. He stepped in. He was glad to have this. He was glad to. He probably didn't care about the divorce that much, but this is a chance for him to assert his authority. Now he had a real issue. And note this: it was an issue he could really use because divorce was a genuinely spiritual issue. You recall that the old decision was that the state is in charge of secular matters, the church in spiritual matters. It was in the church decided which was which. But there's no problem with this, is there? This is clearly a spiritual matter. So Nicholas, he simply threatened to excommunicate the king of Lorraine, Lothair II, one of these feudal kings. He simply said, "I'll excommunicate you if you don't take your first wife back and restore her to her place." And Lothair yielded. He did it. Showing the power of the Bishop of Rome. Hincmar, 865, was Archbishop of Reims. By the way, later on, years and years later, this is, you remember the Douay Reims version of the Bible? Because Roman Catholic, in response to Protestant interpretations, Roman Catholic scholars eventually departed their work on this at the monastery at Reims many years later, same place. Douay Reims up in the Holy Roman Empire. He was the most powerful prelate in France. He did not recognize the authority of the Bishop of Rome over him. He simply said no. When the bishops under him, however, appealed to the Pope against the tyranny of Hincmar, he was something of a despot, Nicholas made his claim to supreme authority by citing the pseudo-Isidorian decretals. Well, Hincmar protested the validity of the new decretals, and he said, okay, if you want to use those in Italy, in Germany, or Holy Roman Empire, that's okay. They don't apply to France. And by the way, this battle, this protest, was kept alive until the Vatican Council of 1870. Believe it or not, Vatican, misprint, Vatican Council. What I want us to see is, by the way, you must see that this idea that the Pope of Rome has authority over the whole Roman Catholic Church, you know, far be it from the donation of Constantine, the Isidorian decretals say this has been that which has been claimed and recognized and acknowledged from the beginning. Do you realize that even in the Roman Catholic Church itself, it was not universally acknowledged. It did not become, quote, the accepted and practiced rule. It did not become universally acknowledged until 1870. Now think about that. Hincmar told him what he could, he says, well, your Isidorian decretals, they're a bunch of, I don't trust them, but even if they are real, they're okay for you guys over there, but not for us, you see, not over here in France. But with the French Catholic Church has always considered itself to be kind of a French national church first, a Catholic church second, a universal church second. And we're going to see this later when we come to the Protestant Reformation. By the way, one of the big lies the Roman Catholic Church has always told is the lie of monolithicity. I made up that word, no. But the Roman Catholic Church is always saying, well, you know, Protestant is all divided up. Roman Catholic Church is monolithic. Absolute baloney. It's never been monolithic. There's more, there have been more divisions, and there are more divisions within the Roman Catholic Church than has ever been among Protestantism. Even back this late period, you see, the Bishop of Rome is telling the Archbishop of Reims in France, but I'm in charge, and he says, you're not, and he refutes the argument, denies the argument from the Isidorian Decretals. And how long did this argument go on? Well, only for 1,000 years. Did France finally get the, it was not settled for 1,000 years. Well, we now look at the church as the pawn of Italian princes. The church went through a very bad period, 739 to 885. We'll look at this very quickly. The papacy reached its lowest point up to this time. The Pope is claiming much. He has authority. But then after Nicholas, who's able to bring Lothair into line over this question of divorcing the queen, the papacy goes into a deep decline as far as its integrity, its power. It reached its lowest point up to this time. Now underline that, up to this time. Because there were no strong rulers in Europe, that is when the Holy Roman Empire fell, it existed only in name. By the way, the Holy Roman Empire existed in name for a long time. The papacy became the pawn of Italian politics, simply because there was nobody else strong enough to stop them. And by the way, Italian culture, Italian society, has been corrupt from the days of the fall of the Roman Empire. It has never been anything since. There's ever a system that is corrupt and cynical and materialistic. It is the society, the culture of northern Italy. Well, Italy in general, but southern Italy is really a backward country. It's been that way ever since. By the way, the kind of thing you see going on, Italy, Sicily, where you have very little law and order, very little morality, much corruption, where it's so ingrained in the culture that they can, for instance, the Italian people can conceive of no culture that is not absolutely corrupt, immoral, self-serving. That's why Italian society never has worked very well. The only one, the man who came the closest to bringing order out of it, of course, was Mussolini, the dictator. We don't like what he did, but he came the closest to bringing order out of it, and that didn't work. The Italians, of course, they simply, that the culture is a corrupt culture and always has been since the time of the Roman Empire. It was then. Now, don't misunderstand me. You just look at its history. I'm not talking about individual. I'm talking about the way that the system works. It's never broken out of that. By the way, look at it today. You see the idea that Italy. You'd think it would be the powerful and moral to see the Roman Catholic Church. Italy was the first country in the world to vote itself communist. Rome, not Italy. Rome has had a communist government in the past. The majority of the officials, elected city officials, were communist, and Rome was the first city in the world to do that. Everywhere else took a revolution, not in Rome. You think about that. The countries that are the most susceptible to communism are Roman Catholic countries, always have been. Although the second country to do that is Brazil, in the process of doing it. The Pope was theoretically elected by the people of Rome, is theoretically. This meant that he was chosen by the princes of the region because the people had, in a feudal system, how do the people vote? The way the feudal lord, the prince, says he votes. And it was a part of the feudal system, a modified feudalism. Talk about that in another class. Different counts controlled Rome, therefore they appointed the popes. You got that? Local feudal princes would simply appoint popes. The pope followed pope, Schopf says, in rapid succession, and most of them ended their career in despotism, prison, and murder. Schopf, I give you the citation here, says this, and what was worse, three bold and energetic women of the highest rank and lowest character, Theodora the Elder, the wife or widow of a Roman senator, and her two daughters,
Marozia and Theodora fill the chair of St. Peter with their paramours and bastards.
That is, their illegitimate children, their lovers, their sweethearts.
Schaff continues, these Roman Amazons combine with the fatal charms of personal beauty and wealth, a rare capacity for intrigue and a burning lust for power and pleasure. They had the badness of St. Paula and St. Eustatium in the days of Jerome. Sorry. They had the diabolical ambition to surpass their sex as much in boldness and badness as St. Paula and St. Eustatium in the days of Jerome had excelled in virtue and saintliness. Sort of sainthood in reverse. They were just as bad as some of these other earlier women were good, you see. They turned the church of St. Peter into a den of robbers, and the residence of his successors into a harem, and they gloried in their shame. Hence, this infamous period is called the papal pornocracy. The word pornos in the Greek, you know, means sexual immorality, pornography. This was called the great papal pornocracy, the rule of immorality. Think about that. Very bad church. And by the way, the Roman Catholic Church admits this. This is a very bad time. Although these, interestingly enough, these men are recognized in the papal succession. These immoral cynics, you know, put there by these women who are very powerful, they recognize as popes. Very reluctantly. They're in the succession. The church, we look at the church and the kings of the Holy Roman Empire, 962 to 1137. And I'm just going to go over this very quickly. I've put in the syllabus the periods of the kings of the Holy Roman Empire, which exists theoretically. And you have, first of all, in the period from 962 to 1024, and I'll list the kings there for you. I'm not going to ask you this on a test. Simply want to know there were three general periods. During the period, this is 962 to 1137 now, which takes us up to the end of our period. First of all, from 962 to 1024, and I give you the emperors, Otto the First, Otto the Second, Otto the Third, Henry the Second. These are the period when the Holy Roman Empire is dominated by princes from the north, the Saxons. The state dominates the church. Secondly, the Franconian emperors, the church struggles with the state, 1024 to 1137. I'll list those kings for you. And last of all, the Hohenstaufen emperors, the church dominates the state. So you go from the state dominating, the church, to the church struggling with the state, to the church dominating the state, 1138 to 1254. That is, the church, as I've already said, won. You see that? The state dominates the church struggles, the church wins out. Otto the First sought to consolidate his territories by appointing bishops and abbots over his lands rather than secular dukes. But he had a method to his madness. You see, the bishops and the dukes weren't supposed to be married. Therefore, they couldn't have any children, so whenever they died, the land would come back into his possession to do what he wanted to. Otherwise, the land was inherited. And once it was in a family, he had to stay with that family. So Otto the First tried to pull this off. He tried to maintain his control over the church in this way, but it did not work very well. Otto the First extended his control to include northern Italy and Rome, and he began to appoint popes. And this constituted what he did was, and this is Otto the Great, it's in the first period, the state dominating the church. You see back here what I'm talking about now. Are you with me? I'm under period one now, the Saxon emperors, the state dominates the church. This is the kind of thing that happened. Otto the First dominated the church. And by the way, it's a good thing he did, from their point of view. He rescued the church from the control of these Italian princes, this exceedingly corrupt system. Henry the Second, and he came at the end of that period of state control over the church. He lost control of Rome because he was very weak, and the papacy once again fell prey to Italian politics. Otto rescued it. Henry lost it. Shaw fries with Benedict the Eighth, and that's the Pope. With Benedict the Eighth, the papal dignity had become hereditary in the Tusculan family, one of these Italian families. He had bought it by open bribery, as the Pope had. He was followed by his brother, John the 19th, a layman who bought it likewise and passed it one day, passed in one day through all the clerical degrees. He bought the papacy, and he became a deacon, a presbyter, a bishop, an archbishop, a patriarchal bishop, a metropolitan bishop, patriarchal bishop, and a bishop of Rome, and the Pope all in one day. A busy, busy day. After his death, this is Benedict VIII, in 1033, his nephew, Theophylact, a boy of only 10 or 12 years of age, ascended the papal throne under the name of Benedict the Ninth. You can look at him in the succession. His election was a mere money bargain between the Tusculan family and the venal clergy and populace of Rome. Once more, Schaff writes, the Lord took from Jerusalem and Judah the stay and staff and gave children to be their princes and babes to rule over them. This boy pope, see, a 12-year-old pope, how'd you like that? This boy pope, fully equal and even surpassed, Schaff writes, John the 12th in precocious wickedness. He combined the childishness of Caligula and the viciousness of Heliogabulus. You can look him up if you want to. What about? You can read about Caligula, the vicious young emperor of Rome in the first century. He grew worse as he advanced in years. He ruled like a captain of banditti, committed murders and adulteries in open daylight, robbed pilgrims on the graves of martyrs, and turned Rome into a den of thieves. These crimes went unpunished, for who could judge a pope? And his brother Gregory was patrician of the city. His brother Gregory was in charge of the city, so here you have a period of decline. Yes. Oh yes, it's infallible, you see. Henry the Third, you see, he's under the second, the period of the church struggling with the state. Henry the Third, the first strong ruler of the Franconian dynasty, steps in and takes control of the papacy. And he appointed a good man to the papacy, Leo the Ninth, as he came to be called, his papal name. By the way, we've already met Leo. It was under his rule that the East and the West split. Do we call that? We've met him before. We're dealing with this topically now. He was the pope who established the College of Cardinals. What he's trying to do is curtail some of these claims made by the Roman pope. It grew from the custom of the pope to consult with a leading, or cardinal, of clerics of Rome, around Rome. Leo chose these advisors from all Europe and gave them the right to elect the pope. This took the vital function from the hands of both the Italian princes and the German emperors. And Henry III was very smart. He was trying to, you see, the idea of having a 12-year-old pervert as a pope, this wasn't a good idea. And so what he's trying to do is to keep the German princes from putting their flunkies in, but also trying to keep these Italian princes in the south from doing the same thing. And so he thought, well, one way to do it is to change the way we elect popes. It's a very smart move, and that is, simply, and he established the College of Cardinals, and by the way, the Roman Church has used that ever since. It still does. Which meant, cardinal means most important, primary. Originally, it was the most important bishops in the area of Rome. Now, they call it the cardinals are elected more systematically. But you see that? It was an attempt to stop this terrible corruption. By the way, and the Constitution, this is interesting to you as a footnote, the Constitution that set up the College of Cardinals is the oldest Constitution in the history in the world that is one that's still working. 1059, still functioning. This move was possible because Henry III died and Henry IV was still a child. That is, what I'm saying is that his mother reigned in his place until he was old enough. She was unable to restrain the papacy in this matter. Now, let's move on. Time's getting away from us. When Henry IV came to manhood, The great conflict with the church for supremacy began. Gregory VII, he was called Hildebrand, he was elected pope, he'd been a monk, and he came to the office with his idea of the papacy. And I put this in the syllabus because here we have the first expression, and we have the church struggling with the state, you see. And Gregory VII, we're going to see is a very popular, very, very influential pope in that he first sets forth a clear expression of the ideals of the medieval papacy. It comes from a context of this struggle of who's going to elect popes and the struggle of the church with the state. I list these ideas for you. First of all, the pope as the absolute head of the church. He sets this forth. This idea had long been developing. It was debated until 1870. It was not legitimized until 1870. He saw himself as the administrative head with absolute authority. He was the supreme legislative head. He was the supreme judicial head. That is, he could hand down decrees unilaterally in his own name. And by the way, the right of the pope to hand down in his own name unilateral decrees, again, was debated until 1870, when infallibility was established. He was the supreme judicial head. He was the final court of appeals. So the first idea is, this will certainly be on the test. Gregory VII, or Hildebrand, out of this mess we've been talking about, sets forward for the first time in a very clear and unmistakable way the ideals of the medieval papacy. See what we're doing here? First of all, the pope as the absolute, underline that word, the absolute head of the church. Legislative and judicial authority. Second, the pope as the supreme authority over any civil ruler, and his power to release people from their obligations to the emperor can depose emperors. Third, in speaking for the church, he is infallible. Got that? Absolute authority over the church, supreme authority over civil rulers, infallibility. Those three concepts are the substance of the Roman Catholic medieval papacy.
Does that mean
yes. The Roman Catholic Church has never said that everything the Pope says is infallible. Only when he's a speaking ex cathedra, as they say, from the chair, from the bishop's chair, the Bishop of Rome. So only when he does this in a very formal way. Not everything. You're wrong about many things. The motive, what was the Gregory's motive, very quickly? He was not an evil, power-grabbing tyrant. Look at this very important statement, and keep in mind the comments I made at the beginning of my lecture today. He saw himself as perhaps the only representative of God who could bring order to chaotic society. And Europe was in the throes of war, local wars, battles for land, feudal supremacy, along with all of its other problems. However, this power was to become a terrible thing in the hands of popes less noble than Gregory. So he wasn't trying to just grab power. He was trying to take charge. Why? Well, somebody had to take charge. Things were a mess. If we look at the reforms of Gregory VII, he tried to implement these ideals. First of all, and I'm just looking at his major reforms, the abolition of clerical marriage. He tried to put a stop to that. It had been customary for priests to marry. But this was an emphatic restatement, 1074, of a law that had been long on the books but broadly ignored. With Gregory VII, you have the actual beginning of the practice of clerical celibacy in the Roman Catholic Church. It has really became a policy, been on the books, but never been sort of been ignored. Schaff again writes, "At last, the Gregorian enforcement of sacerdotal celibacy triumphed in the whole Roman Church. But at the fearful sacrifice of sacerdotal chastity, the hierarchical aim was attained, but not the angelic purity of the priesthood. The private morals of the priest were sacrificed to the hierarchical ambition." That is, when the idea was established by Gregory, what was accomplished? Answer, technically, clerical celibacy. But actually, not. Bischoff writes, concubinage and licentiousness took the place of holy matrimony. Yes, before, it didn't change very much. The only change was that where before priests would marry, now they simply live with women. That is, adultery, fornication took the place of marriage. The acts of councils abound in complaints of clerical immorality and the vices of unchastity and drunkenness. The records of the Middle Ages are full of the evidences that indiscriminate license of the worst kind prevailed throughout every rank of the hierarchy. The corruption reached the papacy, especially in the 15th century. You see, this is a very immoral age. We talk about that, a very dark, superstitious age. Even in the best of times, to enforce celibacy would be a real job. But in this time, you see, in this age, I mean, you would